Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. Peace Revolution and all the media we create here at Tragedy and Hope is presented without corporate sponsorship and is provided commercial-free and free to the public, thanks to the generosity of the members of the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard-working media hosts at TragedyandHope.com. Greetings to those of you around the world. Thank you for taking time to tune in. Today's episode is something which usually can only be heard by the courageous subscribers of Maria Heller's daily productions at Maria.net. And in that forum, Maria splits her time between doing news shows, interviews, and every month or so, we like to record an episode where she and I co-host and get down to business by breaking down the ideas which are used to manipulate and control our behavior, following the notion that you first have to be aware and then apply critical thinking. The topic of our discussion would be the logical third and next step: how to communicate without creating friction, how to add balance, how to avoid emotional reactions and the thoughts and fears which create anger in the first place as a thought long before it ever becomes an action. It also might be of interest, if you're a new listener to this podcast, to note that once upon a time back in 2006, I created a virtual meeting on two CDs titled Project Constellation, and I sent it out to media hosts all over the world who had likewise been researching 9/11. Being a whistleblower, I was naive enough to believe that after 50-plus failed attempts at getting my research out to the public, that one more try wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea. And with that, I took a shot in the dark and sent a package containing Project Constellation to Maria Heller. And unlike Jon Stewart, Alex Jones, Charlie Sheen, and other better-known persons with similar media platforms, Maria listened, and she read the transcript. And Maria published Project Constellation on Memorial Day 2006, not just to her subscribers, but to the entire planet. Which kind of made me do a gut check, because it really hadn't been intended for public distribution. Rather, it was a virtual meeting to urge media hosts and outspoken personalities to research the facts and evidence to which I was pointing. Facts which these people seemed to be ignorant of. Well, regardless of my apprehensions at the time, the two-hour MP3 was downloaded and passed around all over the world. So as Maria would say, there you have it. And that explains the backstory, which leads us into today's journey. Lastly, if you're interested in listening to Project Constellation, it's at the very bottom of the 9/11 Synchronicity podcast page, because that's where it all started. The address, renaissance.libsyn.com. It's also in the show notes. So I encourage you to check out the episode notes, references, and links at peacerevolution.org. And therein, you'll find an invitation to the Tragedy and Hope online community, where Maria is also a member. So if you have any questions from today's episode, don't be afraid to jump in and start participating. This is episode 15, Compassionate Communication, How to Mitigate Conflict in Our Thoughts. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Good morning, world. Maria here, alive and kicking. Welcome to another episode of Tragedy and Hope with my co-host, Richard Grove, the one and only. It's been a while, so I'm pretty excited to be back with Richard. If you're new to the show, and I want to say a big hello to my new listeners, my new subscribers, especially overseas. And if you're not familiar with Richard's work, get over to tragedyandhope.com. Get familiar as soon as you can. And, of course, check the archives. There's lots of good shows with us there. How you doing, Richard? It's been quite some time since we talked.
I'm outstanding, Maria, and good day to your audience, wherever they may be listening across the planet.
Or maybe even off the planet.
I'm glad to hear your audience is growing. That's very encouraging to hear that you're getting the message out and people are actually starting to embrace all the empowerment that you've been spreading over the years.
Well, you know, I think that now that, you know, the police state has become more evident in the United States, I kind of went from being an alarmist and a crackpot to a genius and a prophet. So that might make a difference, too. But I'm like, you know, I only told people about the stuff I saw coming because I figured we could stop it. But unfortunately, what I'm finding is people don't want to get involved unless it affects them. Sooner or later, it will affect them. And, you know, what goes around comes around, and then they wake up. So what have you been up to?
I was just going to say, I think people have failed to see, and maybe, you know, we can take responsibility for it. I'll take responsibility on my end that if people haven't seen how what we've been talking about over the years has applied to them, then, you know, that's my shortcomings in communication, and maybe we can outgrow that with some learning today. But the point would be, after all these years, there's still a big failure to communicate, and it seems like even people who are seemingly in tune, they have a common interest, let's say 9/11 truth, these groups still can't get along with themselves, and it has to come back to, you know, a reevaluation of what are we actually looking for, what are we trying to do, what's working, what's not working, and that kind of ties into the question that you asked, what have we been doing lately, because that's what we've been trying to decrypt is, you know, why is there still all this noise in a signal that we are designing to be as clear as possible? Why are people still failing to get the message? And why are they distracted and emotionally bought into ideas that don't empower them?
Well, I think that, you know, it's a couple of combinations, because I was having a very similar discussion this morning with my car salesman, to tell you the truth. And I said to him that some people choose to be willfully ignorant, and some people are just so overworked and so tired, they just can't handle one more thing. And then, of course, you have the lying media, you know, lamestream, and what passes as alternative media, lying to them as well, or screaming at them, you know, creating fear from yet another different direction, but it's still fear. So I think those are some of the reasons. I don't think it's a failure to communicate on our part, or we wouldn't still be here. You know, I would have been off the air a long time ago.
Right. Well, I think there's the first level, which is awareness, and there's a large group of us who have become aware that we're being lied to. And for the past several years, I think we've just tried to communicate to other people that they're being lied to as well. And their failure to get it is partly because they're so comfortable in their day-to-day status quo environment, and partly because this unknown presents fears to them, and they don't have any way to deal with the day-to-day confusion, let alone introduce any new unknowns that's going to take them further away from getting their proverbial pellet, in a Skinner sense, their reward, right?
Right.
So the status quo is set up such that they create on one side a wall of fear, and the other side is a wall of pain. And unless you're willing to go through one of these two sides, it's a funnel, and you're going to end up in their game. But if you can go through a little fear or through a little pain, and this pain isn't really pain, it's just the illusion of losing pseudo-comfort, which is provided by the status quo, to come into contact with reality, which is where we all connect with our needs and our feelings, and we're able to communicate with each other on that level. But when we're trying to, let's say that there's two groups of people, and there's one group of people that has had public schooling and they've done some learning on their own, and they're trying to communicate to a group of people who only has public schooling. Mm-hmm. Well, the whole point of the communication is to communicate this part that the group who only has public schooling hasn't been exposed to, but the group that only has public schooling has been conditioned to think that they've already been given all of this information. And so there's like many layers that have to be resolved in order to successfully communicate a message like what we've been talking about for these past years, insofar as all these events have commonalities. There's a deceptive layer, and in order to deceive us, we first had to trust them and believe in their lies. That's how they got power over us in the first place. The way to outgrow that status quo is to introduce a process of learning whereby we are teaching ourselves consistently, not only through critical thinking, but the output of that, how we interact with other people through compassionate communication, so as to empathize with the people we're trying to communicate with and not dehumanize anybody in the process, including our, you know, quote-unquote opposition, the people that we're speaking out against.
Mm. Right, exactly. So I know that you've been super busy with all kinds of films and things that you've been doing. What's the reaction been? How far are you guys spreading around?
Well, it's not something we really keep that tight of control. Like, I don't watch the numbers on the videos or anything like that, really. What I can see as a metric is that there are people from all over the world, every continent except for Antarctica, who have come into the Tragedy and Hope community as a function of either hearing the Peace Revolution podcast or seeing some of Paul Verge's work or Jan's work or James Corbett's work or Pilato's work. There's a, you know, all of our work is leading people to realize that there's people all over the planet who are trying to answer these same basic questions, who have encountered these same limitations in their public school educations, who have encountered these same type of frictions that arise when they try to communicate with families and friends. Mm-hmm. And seeing almost 600 of these people in Tragedy and Hope, many of whom English is not a first language for them, being able to communicate in a fear-free zone where questions are raised and different perspectives are discussed, and I think everyone has a chance to sharpen themselves and grow from the experience. And I really haven't seen anybody try to beat anyone over the head with their ideology or their belief, because that doesn't go on for too long when you're in a place where everyone's trying to learn how to be autonomous and become firsthand thinkers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, you know, I think that, you know, we're living in a society right now where everybody has so much fear. I mean, I think a good example are these body scanners at the airport. It's a body scanner or strip search. And people are afraid to speak up. So they're not speaking up at all, and they're subjecting themselves to, you know, harmful radiation, danger, humiliation, molestation, beatings, tasering, and forgetting that we're supposed to have the freedom of speech in this country and the freedom of privacy. So how does that fit in to what you're talking about?
Well, I think that everything that we've been producing, especially over the past year, has been focused on solving real problems that people are encountering day to day. The TSA is a great example, where people are just trying to travel to see loved ones, let's say on a holiday, and they're being forced to either get groped, and I'm not sure when our family jewels became known as junk, but you're either groped or you're sent through a radiation scanner. There are ways to logically deal with this and to use words to get through the process with the least amount of hassle as possible without losing your rights, without having to compromise. But because we, as a population, 99% of us lack intellectual self-defense, we lack the ability to communicate concisely with certainty and using a common ground, by refusing to be a victim, by using words in your own defense and being able to deal with their structure, because there is a bureaucratic structure. I heard a great call on this where a guy had gone through the TSA and used logic and rhetoric to go through the TSA and basically get, you know, around the process. So it's a nonviolent or a compassionate way of communicating, even with authority structures, especially with authority structures. But I find it more useful as people apply to their friendships and their family relationships, because I think that's where a lot of the friction in how we learn to talk to each other started and can be best be addressed in ourselves before letting that affect larger groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is a time where a lot of people are spending time with their extended family that they probably avoid all year long. I did get some emails from some of my listeners, some of my friends, telling me how hard it was being around their family, you know, how many fights and misunderstandings and, you know, the TV blaring and, you know, you can't talk politics and all of this, and how basically miserable they were being around their family. Do you think it's because they don't know how to speak to their listening?
I think there's a number of reasons. They start internally with how we perceive information. We're all taught to judge things instead of just observing things. And, you know, there's two ways to look at it. To evaluate without observing is the highest form of ignorance, and to observe without evaluating is the highest form of intelligence. So the idea is, in these family situations, all too often we observe things, but then we attach our judgments to these things.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people out there who are professional speakers who handle these types of family and friend interactions, professionally addressing them in books and whatnot, like Byron Katie or Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. But the ideas behind it are the basis of things like anger start in your mind with a fear and a misunderstanding or a lack of knowledge. And instead of going through a process to attain that knowledge, we try to displace those feelings and use scapegoats. And our culture, Western culture, has been conditioned to do this for thousands of years. So it's not anyone's particular fault that's living today, but this is something, again, that we've inherited through the status quo and that we have not thought about before. But when you observe the words we use to talk to each other, there's a lot of what could be called cognitive violence and aggression and coercion in a lot of the ways that we've all been trained unwittingly to speak to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start to change that in how you think for yourself, and then you start to change that as you communicate with other people, they basically would have to be super illogical or super irrational to kind of fight their way out of that, because it is a common ground where you do have shared needs and they can't disconnect themselves and they can't dehumanize you. And these are all the things that TSA is trying to do. They're trying to make you feel like you're an animal, a piece of cattle going
uh-huh.
through a piece of meat going through the system, right? Being
right.
checked.
Uh-huh.
And that is not what we are. So in order to do that, I think we have to learn for ourselves as individuals. And once we do that, we can take that everywhere we go with us in all these interactions. And sooner or later, it may not work the first time on a TSA agent, but if you integrate a learning process and figure out what went wrong or what could have been done better, and multiple people try this, their short-sighted, deception-based processes of control cannot hold consciousness in from solving those problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you mentioned Marshall Rosenberg. You know, many years ago, I interviewed him on his teaching, which is nonviolent communication. And I don't even know where that archive is. Maybe one day I'll dig it up. But I think that you're right. You know, a lot of people really don't realize the power of their words. They don't realize where their words are coming from, where their thoughts or beliefs are coming from, but they just parrot whatever they've heard before, whether it's from the media or whether it's from their parents. Or their church people, you know, whatever. And a lot of times, you know, it's just words. People say it's just words. But I heard you use a word earlier in the show that I pretty much slapped down my car dealer today. He says, I'm trying to make the best salesman of the month or something like that. I guess whoever sells the most cars, right? And I said to him, but you just said you're trying, so you're not going to do it. And he realized what I had just said to him. I says, now say it again. I'm the best car salesman this month. I said, it's a whole different ball of wax when you are aware of your words.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I make those mistakes all the time, but it's observing those mistakes.
Right.
And seeing
those
mistakes as opportunities to learn and outgrow your habits.
Exactly. I mean, we all do. There are times I have to catch myself or I'll just say, wait a minute, I cancel that thought. But being aware of how we present ourselves, whatever it is, to the rest of the world or, you know, in prayer or whatever people do to beseech the powers of the universe is really important. You know, I have a friend, I'll tell you, it's pretty funny, Rich. For the past few years, he's probably 55. He will say, joking around, when I'm old, I'll probably be homeless and crippled and starving. And I said, do you realize by saying that, whether it's joking or not, that's what you're creating? And I don't think people are aware of, you know, how energy, sound, vibration work to create our reality.
Well, if they were aware of it, then you would have to look at it like this. So whether you're aware of it or not aware of it, I think somebody could understand this metaphor. When there is so many billions of dollars spent every year on creating unrealities, what do you think the consequence of that's all going to be? If we are creating unreality for our children, if we are putting violence on TV every time that you turn on the TV, here's a show about solving murders,
mm-hmm.
right? Here's a show about war. here's a show about inner city violence. All these things are mixed in, not to mention the news. And so when you're filling the world with all these pieces of unreality that are highly polished, highly funded pieces of propaganda that are about consciousness suppression, then the only solution that I could see to that is people creating art that is helping people to do consciousness expression, teaching people how to use what they already have. You have a treasure trove of words if you can learn to use them to your advantage. Mm-hmm. But the whole system is set up such that the people in control took control of the words a long time ago. They created things called mortgages, you know, death pledges. They created contracts. They created financial instruments that nobody understands. And they get us all to trust in them as experts or as people divinely given rights to rule over other people. These ideas of monarchy came with these ideas of judgments, and judgments tie into law, and law ties into money. So when you get down to it, it's, you know, it all comes back to ideas that have been here for thousands of years that we're only now able to use the resources around us to start putting all these pieces together. And I think it's one of the most fascinating times in human history, because we are here in the middle of it trying to, no, we are not trying. We are doing the research every day that is digging this up and presenting it in small little nuggets around the internet so that people who are interested and conscious of these things now and in the future can save themselves a lot of time, effort, struggle, and faster, like they can afford themselves a faster integration back to reality, which is what we're all trying to get to right now.
Well, it's, you know, it's very interesting because this week I think I used the quote by John Lennon probably 15 times where he said reality leaves a lot to the imagination.
Reality is an illusion, albeit a persistent one, said Einstein.
Right. A persistent illusion. And that's the truth of it. But of course, that's a hard one for a lot of people to get to. Talking about illusion, all right, when I was younger, we realized as young children, you know, in New York City, that we would be alive and actually witness the new millennium. We were so excited as children that we would live to see the turn of the year 2000. And in those days, we actually fantasized that it was going to be a time of high intellect. It was going to be, you know, high technology. We'd all be flying around in cars. There'd be peace on Earth. And then the reality of 2000 hit.
Well, I think that you're not alone in having that illusion-based ideal of the year 2000, because I remember when I was a kid, I was calculating how old I would be, and I was like, I'm going to be 24 in the year 2000, and I'm going to live in New York. And I'm going to have this whole status quo dream that I've been chasing since I was like old enough to watch Chips and these other shows that I watched as a kid, right? It gives you some ideas, and then you start chasing those ideas that you form as a young child watching television, right? You spend the rest of your years chasing those. So when you bring it back to this illusion-based culture that we've all been forced into, we've been force-fed in trying to not only break yourself away from it, to wean yourself off of it, but to not be alone in that process and be able to communicate with friends and family in such a way that you're speaking freely, your parhesia, your attempt to speak the truth, even at your own expense, is not scrambled out by all these emotional reactions that they've used psychological techniques and psychological warfare on the audience to get them to shut off logic and reason and to shut off family members who might be trying to communicate with them.
Right.
Right. And that makes you, you know, or made me as a whistleblower take a step back and say, whoa, even though I know this is kind of hard to believe, I have this evidence and I'm related to these people. So why are they having such a hard time seeing what is so obvious if you only integrate these other pieces of information that you haven't been spoon-fed? Right.
Right.
And then you get down to people's emotional investment in beliefs that do not serve their needs. Yet we're so emotionally attached to them. We have emotional beliefs and investments in things that we haven't observed or studied. So you have to ask yourself, what kind of crazy conditioning gets people to be so attached to things that they've never even really studied or might not be interested in if they did?
Right, and they'll still argue and get wild over it.
Right, and how does anyone benefit from that? I think, rather, it's a type of conditioning that has been instilled among the prisoner population, which is the 99% of the people on this planet, and it keeps us from making progress or threatening the control structures. But once we learn how to communicate within ourselves, like Marshall Rosenberg said when he was mediating between these tribes in Africa, the one chief stood up and said, hey, if we knew how to talk like this, we wouldn't have to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
That is the true meaning. If I had an idea or an illusion of civilization growing up, that was kind of what I understood it could be, a place where people don't have to kill each other to kind of resolve differences, a place where some people don't have to be preyed on by these other people, where people had intellectual self-defense, because in 99% of the times in your life, you don't need to defend yourself physically, but every day you need to defend yourself from these ideas that are bombarding you from the status quo, whether it's through advertising or news or the guy knocking on your door or the IRS or whoever who's trying to tell you what to do every day.
Mm.
You need to be able to defend yourself, to separate yourself from that, to not take it personally, and to start looking at life through observations without adding your own judgments on there, because it's those additional judgments that are preventing us all from communicating clearly.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know,
hearing what our needs and feelings actually are, and that's what leads to the solutions. That's what can lead to peace.
Well, I think that absolutely nonviolent communication is important, but I also think that living your life, just live your life, is important, and I'll tell you why I'm saying that. Everybody on Facebook has been, you know, bitching, moaning, and all paranoid about this new food bill, which they passed today, which I knew they would, that S-510. And what they've convinced themselves of is that it's no longer going to be legal to have organic farming or an organic garden or a garden of their own. Which, of course, is not the case. You know, too bad they don't all listen to my show, because I discussed just that with Alexis Baden-Meyer last week with
organic consumers. Right.
And what I find interesting is people now have actually posted, the best thing that I can do about this bill is grow an organic garden. No one's going to tell me what I can and can't do. So it seems like the more suppression that the government comes down with, people are starting to realize that they don't have to follow along. They don't have to be compliant. They don't have to keep their mouth shut and just march to the, you know, new Nazi drumbeat. All they can do is choose not to participate and live their lives. And to me, who's going to stop you from growing a garden? You know, I mean, this is where it starts. It's almost the same as, you know, all these people rejecting the TSA now. Maybe that's what they needed to wake up. You know, they needed to see their wives or daughters molested or themselves naked or whatever. And I think that people just learning how to say no and saying, wait a minute, I can still have a garden if I want. I don't really care what the politics has to say.
Well, I think people are finally waking up to the fact, and it's about time, that they don't have to give their consent to these activities. They no longer have to give their consent. If something's going on that you don't approve of, you do not have to give your consent, and nobody can force you to give your consent or give up your rights. You need to learn how to use words to defend yourself. And in the case of the TSA, it's awful what they've done to people, but yes, that is waking some people up. And the gardening, that is waking people up. Nobody's going to come around and play garden police. They do not have the resources to do it. Please grow your own food. Grow your own garden. Do not yield to the fear. Do not give the pricks the satisfaction. It is that simple. Everything that they've set up in the status quo is based on your consent. Withdraw your consent, withdraw your attention, rededicate your attention and your consent to people who have been out there trying to accumulate this information and empower you in ways that go way beyond what corporate media would ever imagine trying to communicate to you.
All right. Well, now we have this great new phrase, thanks to TSA. We can just say, I choose to opt out. You know, people said to me, Maria, what are you doing for Thanksgiving? I said, I'm opting out. And they laughed. But I said, you know, I don't believe in the holiday. I don't believe in the lies we were told about it. And I've chosen not to have any stress. And the best way not to have holiday stress is just opt out. There's no law that says you have to participate.
There's no law. Well, first off, we shouldn't think of family get-togethers as state holidays. Anytime you have a family get-together and have a family meal, that can be a holy day. And you can do that without considering Black Friday or the TSA schedule or any of these things. Start to work independently. Have those family holidays, those birthdays at home. Make meals. Have your friends and family over. And if that means traveling, then certainly go through that process with full knowledge of how to defend yourself intellectually and figure out where you need to draw your line. If your goal is to go and spend time with your friends and family, do not let them and their scare tactics prevent you from expressing your freedom or sharing your time with your friends and family, because that's what life's all about. And they're trying to drain us of that essential connection that allows us to connect with our family face-to-face, and they want us to do it through the Internet, and they want us to do it through Skype and these things. And there is nothing more important today than being able to get out and see your family and to travel freely in the midst of their apparent, you know, attempts to tyrannize you. Mm. If you understand the facts of the situation, you understand there's not really danger out there. They're trying to use these illusions of danger to ramp up security, and you do not have to capitulate to those fearful tactics if you arm yourself with information and a systematic process to deal with the unknown.
Right. Well, yeah,
I forget which
guest I had on about a week or two ago, but he used the term synthetic fear. You know, we live in a world of synthetic fears, you know, synthetic terrorism, synthetic this and that. And you just have to realize it and say, I'm still going to live my life and I'm going to be happy. I can choose to be happy and not participate. Now, let me ask you this. So, okay, you're taking your nonviolent communication to the airport. Say you yourself are going to get on a plane and fly out to Phoenix.
Sure.
How will you handle them saying, are you going to go through the body scanner, sir?
I would ask them the question, is it mandatory? Are you going to arrest me if I don't? To which they don't have an answer. They cannot arrest you for not going through the body scanner. And then I would articulate the need. I understand your need to ensure that I'm not doing anything that I'm not supposed to be doing as far as carrying things on this plane. I also have the need for you not to fondle my genitals. Mm-hmm. So somehow we're going to have to negotiate. I understand your needs. I don't blame you. You are just a guy here or a woman here who's trying to earn their living and put food on your kids' plates, right? But neither one of us wants to compromise national security. And if you have a need for security, which is why you're working for TSA, and you have a need for a paycheck, let's not put that all in danger by me having to say that, for instance, when someone holds you against your will without arresting you and they are armed, that's aggravated kidnapping. Now, we certainly wouldn't want that because that would go against your needs of putting the paycheck and, mm-hmm. and all this sort of stuff to go. And it goes against my needs because I don't want to have to do that today. I just want to get on this plane. So I'm totally cooperating with you. I just want you to know that I'm not going to blindly capitulate and be a sheep, but I'm also letting you know I'm not any threat. And I'm not going to be violent because I'm not going to raise my voice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that would be a good way of handling it. Somebody else had said, though, we could all just dress up like Muslim women. They're not getting checked. For me, I guess it would depend on how good looking the person was, and I'd ask if I could feel them up, too. You know, I always try to go with comedy first, shock value of comedy. But, you know, I think that a lot of people, and they've proven, you know, there was a lot less people flying on Thanksgiving. And this really did touch a nerve. I mean, somebody even sent me a body scanner calendar for 2011, which was like all nude poses of, you know, skeletal people seen through the machine. But the fact that I am noticing, you know, the attitude of people online, especially in these social media places, and saying, you know, I don't really, they'll have to, he said, they'd have to pry my lettuce from my cold dead hands. I mean, you could see that these are now becoming issues that people are actually concerned with. They don't seem to have been concerned with the stolen election of 2000. They weren't concerned with 9/11 truth. They weren't concerned with the whole world's economy crashing. But as soon as you start fondling them or telling them what they can and can't grow in their garden, it's pretty interesting that these are things that touch people deeply. No pun intended.
Well, and I think, you know, in some ways, the whole TSA crackdown backfires, as these things always do when they're coming from a position of tyranny. And because it wakes people up in their lives, lets them know it's the noble lie. It's their belief in the noble lie. It's their belief that you can elect someone else to represent you and your concerns. And that's ludicrous. I wouldn't, you know, most of us would not pick somebody in their neighborhood to go and represent them and their concerns to someplace else, let alone something that we just all vote for blindly without ever meeting these candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that, like, that whole illusionary process exists because of our unwillingness to look into it, our innocence, you know, when we're not inspecting these things, but we're supporting it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our innocence, our ignorance, however you want to put it. The point is, the noble lie is perpetrated because we all give our trust out blindly to these authority figures. And it's easy to do because of the conditioning and propaganda with Hollywood and the media and everything like that. But at some point, you have to be an intellectually smart, over-emotionally reactive adult. You have to mature to that point and recognize these people are deceiving everybody, not just, you know, people who aren't so smart. They're fooling some of the smartest people in the world and ripping them off, right?
Yeah.
So there is advanced intelligence working here. I think it's human. I'm pretty sure it's human. Human history is just a big thread of people playing tricks on other people and people lying and basically taking power, right?
Hmm.
That's the history that we have here as human beings. It's not all these great events like it's painted. I mean, it's really a dastardly tale of manipulation through the ages, right?
Mm-hmm.
With power always cleverly hiding behind these stories but never really showing itself through these stories, right?
Right.
So when you understand how all this works and you see that it's been going on for thousands of years and it's only now with this technology and this mix of chaotic situations that allows us to achieve some semblance of awareness, and now we can start to understand it and put it into an order that we can take action on. Again, it's a unique opportunity that I think more of us should have an interest in than, you know, just us, but
right.
Grows slowly.
Well, you know, you mentioned the noble lie, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about what the noble lie is in your mind, but let's hold that for after break, because we're going to go to a short break if I can get it all going right. And stay with us. Let's figure out what is the noble lie. So Richard and I will be right back. Okay, welcome back. Tragedy and Hope with myself and Richard Grove. If you're not familiar with Rich, there's a live link right here. Just click on through to tragedyandhope.com. Support the people that are actually in it with you. Okay, neither one of us are multimillionaires telling you what to do or what to think or what to say. We're in it with you, and we're figuring it out as we go along and sharing our love and knowledge with you. Rich, before the break, you mentioned a lot of what we live under is based on deception and people believing the noble lie. Is the noble lie one particular lie, or is it pretty much everything?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Maria. I first learned about it through listening to this podcast that my friend Jan did, and it was interviewing this professor named Dr. Michael Ranella, who wrote a book called Pharmacon. And the book specifically focused on the use of psychedelic drugs in Plato's culture. And basically, the Pharmacon was known as this proverbial drug that they would put over on the masses, insofar as, you know, it being an illusion or a ruse, a cunning attempt to trick the citizens such that they would believe that what's being done to them is for their own best interest, and that there is a group of people who are in control such that if the people ever knew the truth about the nature of their control, the people would rebel. So Plato hypothesizes in his book, The Republic, that they would need this pharmacon, this noble lie, this magnificent myth to be able to trick the people into loving their servitude, as Aldous Huxley more recently said.
Mm. Well, kind of reminds me of a quote from Napoleon. He said that religion was invented to keep the poor from murdering the rich. You know, and, you know, so many programs out there for us to just simply seem to be okay to accept our serfdom. And, you know, we have our kings and queens, except here, you know, we'll call them the president and first lady, or, you know, now everybody wants to make a big brouhaha about, you know, Prince whatever and his girlfriend over in the UK. And I'm like, people have to snap out of it, snap out of the fairy tale crap. First of all, I wondered how long that girl's going to live. And then I said, you know, here you have people starving all over the UK. They've spied on, you know, they're abused in every which way. You know, their austerity cuts are unbelievable. And yet everybody's all excited over their new prince and, you know, future queen. You know, why do we need to have this divine rule? And why, you know, why celebritize one bloodline over the other or anybody as being any better than any of us?
Well, I think it's interesting if we could just go back to your Napoleon quote for a second. If Napoleon was a bishop, he probably would have said that monarchies and governments were created so that the people don't kill the rich. So I think that he's kind of veiling his position as, well, he wanted to be in control politics-wise, so he blames religion, right?
Mm.
But both religion and politics, the church and the state, are one and the same creation in the past. They split and gave us the illusion that we have freedom from church and state. But church and state, really, when you look at the history and you look at who's in control now, have never been separated, because to believe in the separation of church and state is to believe in the illusion of government and religion in the first place, because you don't understand the piece of grammar, which is the additional knowledge base of the noble lie. Once you understand that there is this thing called the noble lie, that it has been used for thousands of years successfully by all these rulers. This is what Machiavelli is describing. This is what Hegel is describing. Hegel didn't invent or discover anything other than he saw a process repeating through history, and he gave a name to it. He's like, oh, it'd be useful if I could just refer to this as my dialectic. There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right. Problem,
so
reaction,
it's
solution.
It's all about recognizing that history is continuing to repeat because, specifically, we have not learned from it. And so, therefore, we have to expand our minds and raise our awareness, because if the solutions are not directly in our vision, then they exist out there someplace where we have to expand our awareness of what exists or what potentially is there by use of artifacts and hypothesization from there. But without starting at some reality, your hypothesis is never going to be near to actual or factual.
Mm.
And so it comes back to using our ability through the five senses to observe our reality, to take in and discern fact from fiction, to eliminate contradictions and say, hey, wait a minute, it doesn't make sense that Al Gore is telling the truth here because of this, this, and this. And once you understand these other pieces of data that they seek to hide, because it creates an illusion when you hide and veil some of these facts,
mm-hmm.
right? And what you want to really see is what's behind the curtain making those effects on stage work. What makes Al Gore seem so smart? Oh, well, there's all these millions of dollars put into that production. Oh, there's this skewing of data that makes him look like he's a rock star for discovering this. Of course he's the first to discover those things. They just made those points up.
Right. Exactly. Right, exactly. So, okay, back to the question. Is the noble lie one particular lie, or is it all the lies?
Okay, so it is in history in the Republic, this idea that is set forth. So it is that one lie, the idea, and then it's the use of that idea to create the status quo for the past several thousand years. So when you're looking at chemtrails, well, that's part of the noble lie. The noble lie is like this veil behind which everything that is going on in reality is known, but it's not being shown to the audience. And so we are all trying to lift this veil. And that's what an apocalypse is. It's the lifting of a veil so you can see what's really going on. And once people see what's really going on for the first time in human history, it's no wonder that the Bible is scared of this apocalypse, because they're like, their jig is up. Their corporation is over. Their control over people will cease to be control. And if people use the Bible as an inspirational spiritual book, great, but it's no longer going to be used as a control system in the future once people understand the nature of why words were structured that way, to have people judging each other and have all these crazy rules set up that purposely put people into conflict and give a very small percent, 1% of people on this planet, all the power, while the 99% of the people sit here and some of them are under the belief that they are empowered and free and whatnot. But when you look at the history, it has not happened yet.
Right.
But it can happen if we learn from history.
Mm. One of the things that a lot of my listeners tend to tell me, and I don't know if you get the same question asked to you, is how can they communicate what they've learned or what they're learning or what they know to people who are not aware? I think that's where most of the family fights, arguments, et cetera, come in.
Well, let me use an example from personal experience. If I were to go to somebody and say 9/11 is an inside job, that may very well be true, but I have not presented them with any data that would allow them to likewise draw that conclusion and agree with what I'm saying. So I'm almost starting with the cart before the horse. And when people do that, it immediately sets off people's emotional triggers to respond, because they know that can't be true, because otherwise somebody else would have told them, because everyone thinks they're in the know.
Right?
So they get their ego involved. They get their feelings hurt. Well, if that was going on, I would know about it. Somebody would have told me, right? So all these things start to trigger, and then they're justified by the fact that you've said this thing that's incendiary without providing the set of grammar, the underlying facts, and connecting those facts together to an understanding, which is logic, before presenting your rhetoric, which would be, obviously, 9/11 is an inside job.
Uh-huh.
But if you share those, if you first ask the questions, do you have a need for security? Do you have these common needs? And once the person opens up and says, yes, I have these common needs, I need fresh air and clean food and soil to grow food in, and I understand all these things are being polluted and they're becoming toxic because of these corporations. And once you connect with their needs, we have the same needs. Okay, so do you have a need for, you know, travel? And, oh, TSA. So you find what their concerns are. Well, everything that's going on at the TSA goes back to the Patriot Act. And everything that's in the Patriot Act goes back to continuity of government, which was invoked on 9/11. I just read a professor, Peter Dale Scott from Berkeley, wrote like a 15-page paper on the origins of all this TSA molestation and the use of Nazi-like techniques to control people and to use intimidation and coercion. And he ties it all into continuity of government. And there's like three pages of footnotes at the end with all these links where he's getting this information. So for people not to be made aware of that through the corporate media, I think is criminal. But I'm not looking to blame anyone here or try to incarcerate. I don't see that as productive to our needs. Our needs are to get people informed in a balanced manner that's not emotionally charged, and to get people to be autonomous so that they can make up their own mind, make their informed decisions, and be regret-free in those decision-making processes. But it has to start with recognizing that everything that you think you're making correct decisions based upon is based upon this noble lie, and therefore every decision you're making is benefiting the control system that is bleeding us all dry right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I think that, you know, one of the key words you said was, you know, emotions, and people do have strong emotional reactions. And, you know, it takes me back to, you know, years ago when I was studying the teachings of Buddha. I couldn't understand why he said, you know, you need to learn to detach from your emotions, because everything I had learned about being a human was that you were here to experience emotions. That's the difference between you and, you know, anything else. And then I finally understood it didn't mean not have emotions, but he meant don't be controlled by your emotions. And when you see some of the arguments between people and how things escalate, you can see that they're really coming from their emotions and whatever programmed those emotions in their past, instead of really coming from logic, you know, just thinking before they start, you know, going wild with each other.
Well, I think we're all conditioned to react that way. Children react emotionally because they are not thinking. They're not going through a thought process. They are reacting emotionally. The thing that differentiates, the characteristic which differentiates children from adults, is that adults can use their intellect to put their emotions in check for purposes of self-preservation and purposes of making progress. So while you might have emotions about X, Y, or Z, you have to first question those emotions. Where did you get such strong feelings about that? Does that play into your long or short-term needs? Is it benefiting you in any way to make a judgment right there and hold a grudge, or to say that somebody else is wrong? Because who are you to say that somebody else is wrong? We might not like the things they're doing, right? I mean, I always try to, when I hear Rosenberg talk like that, I was like, I think in extremes. I'm like, well, how isn't a pedophile wrong for doing that, right? And it's not about the wrongness. It's about how do we stop behavior like that from proliferating and going on? How do we stop people from thinking that is okay to aggress on another human being and to take away their freedom, their self, their soul, all of this that comes along with those types of interactions, right?
Right.
So it's not so much that these people aren't quote-unquote wrong, so far as, like, when wrong comes up, then it's like, we'll punish them. Well, punishing them doesn't solve anything because anger begets anger.
Right.
And we just become, like, we've been conditioned in Western culture to see the hero at the end of every movie become the killer, become the aggressor. You know, it's always the good guy who shoots the bad guy. Well, you know, at the end of the day, murder is still murder, and that's still not a creative or constructive way to deal with our problems and issues as human beings, supposedly civilized.
Right. Well, you know, we've talked before on a few of our shows about critical thinking. But critical thinking obviously isn't enough unless you match it with compassionate communication. Now, when you talk about compassionate communication, what does that mean to you?
It means taking responsibilities for my own thoughts and feelings and seeing myself and my interactions as not caused by other people trying to use guilt induction or anything like this. It's about clarifying what are my purposes, what am I trying to do, and having a policy of trying to go about achieving those goals without taking away anyone else's free will of thought or mind or action. Mm-hmm. It means taking into consideration that whoever is causing what we are perceiving as problems, these people are human beings who have been through their lives and have had struggles just like everyone else. And the fact that dehumanization is what is used by the sources that create the status quo and maintain the status quo to create cultures of war, I don't see dehumanizing or creating this idea of an enemy or opposition, the aristocratic elite, if you will, right? We'll give them a name, but you don't need to see them as less than human. They are people with problems and just access to billions of dollars, which makes their problems look a lot bigger than the ones we have day to day. And they cause problems for a lot more people than we are ever able to cause in our daily actions, because the actions taken by these few billionaires are poisoning thousands of people and creating an environment that makes it possible impossible for humanity to continue growing into the future. So that's why I think it's important to focus on the root causes and address these issues instead of trying to bang at the leaves or branches on the top of the tree, because at the end of the day, that does not help the future. But if we address these root causes and begin to learn for ourselves how to speak to each other in kinder ways, where we're not trying to have a win-lose situation, where we're not trying to blame people back and forth, are we looking for progress or are we looking to win? Because I don't think the two go together. I think those are mutually exclusive. We are either looking to progress and to survive as humanity with our humanity intact, or we're looking to profit, which is what corporate, cartel capitalism wants us to do. And I don't see humanity's survival and the corporate profit model being able to survive together. I think that the corporate needs and the status quo are in direct conflict with our needs as human beings.
Unless we recognize that,
we are all participating in ongoing psychopathy. So I say drop that ball.
Drop it indeed. What do you think about, or do you think it's important to have compassion, to be kind to ourselves, to actually have compassion for ourselves? What I find, Rich, especially when I'm dealing with some of my clients, is they can have as much compassion and love and forgiveness for everybody in their lives that have treated them like slaves or dogs, but they have a really hard time being compassionate, loving, or forgiveness to themselves.
Well, I think it's our failure to recognize our own innate value, and that's what allows us to be abused by others while failing to maintain it for ourselves. And if you just start with being kind in your thoughts to yourself, looking at mistakes as opportunities to learn and keeping on yourself to learn, but don't talk to yourself in your head like they would have you talk to yourself from TV. You are not an idiot when you make a mistake. You should not, think that you're a failure. None of these things benefit you, and they're not actually true. These are ways that they've tricked us into being like self-imploding anytime that we try to do something, because they fail to give us the tools that we need for success. But it doesn't mean that we can't be successful. once we've had access to these tools, which is what TragedyandHope.com is designed for and Peace Revolution is designed for, to help people come up to speed and start to learn themselves how to deal with themselves, to deal with their thoughts and these sort of things.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I totally agree. And I think that that's a good starting point, you know, for anybody listening today, is to actually be honest with themselves and say, do you really love yourself? Do you put your needs first? Or do you really still believe that you're here to do for everybody else and you're just, you know, some kind of slave or do, you know, Johnny Do-Good, and you're here to suffer? You know, there are a lot of people that really believe that they're here to serve others and it doesn't matter if they're suffering.
Well, I mean, there's one thing to serve others, but to serve others at the cost of your own existence, you really need to have a good reason. Like, you might risk your life for your own child or a family member or a friend, but the idea of going off to a foreign land to try to kill other innocent people with the excuse that my state told me to do it, or my government told me to do it, or the Marines or the Army or whoever is telling you to do it. I mean, that's a shortcut to thinking, and there's no reason that you should outsource your thinking and your free will to someone who has less respect for you than you have for yourself. And if you think about it, it just doesn't make any sense to do that.
Well, you know, I was thinking just that yesterday when I saw that Iraq war veteran get beat up and tasered at the airport, at McCarran Airport. I have the video on my front page if anybody wants to look at it. Here's a guy who served two tours in Iraq, and he says, I'm supposed to be there, you know, defending our freedom. He got the crap beat out of him, you know, all kinds of physical injury, and tasered at the airport, regardless of the fact that he's, you know, support the troops. And I wondered in my own mind, what did that do to his sense of reality? If he honestly believed he's fighting for our freedoms, never gets hurt by an Iraqi or supposed terrorist, and gets beaten, you know, the crap beat out of him by two security guards at an airport, I wondered how he was processing that mentally more than physically.
Well, how does anyone come, like, to deal with coming face-to-face with hypocrisy? I mean, he thinks he's there for one reason, but then he kind of learns it's just all about intimidating people, and they really don't even care who you are. They just want to, you know, use their will and use their badge and use their gun and intimidate you, and it has nothing to do with protecting or serving anyone other than the 1% who are controlling their security companies all the way down through the chain.
Right. They're just there to protect the rich from us.
Right. And you can't blame somebody who's willing to take $27,000 and go and mistreat people and call that a job or call that making a living, because in the culture that we've all grown up in, that's just what happens when you don't think for yourself. That's the status quo. It's the other people who are actually thinking and considering and still trying to remain human in these situations and having empathy and sympathy that are realizing that, hey, wait a minute, maybe we don't need to go this crazy on ourselves. Maybe this is all misdirection to keep us from actually identifying who's molesting all of us every day through their lies and manipulation. And then that we can all find a common ground and identify and say, yep, there's definitely a coherent body of people who act like they're above the law and think that they can lie to us and put the future of this planet and the human race like on the brink of extinction. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's a little too ballsy, and that more and more people are taking notice, and that means they're going to be able to get less and less done over time.
Right. Well, you know, for me, you know, wherever I am, you know, I have no control over my mouth. My mouth is now a separate part of my body. I always look for a segue, some way to talk to people, no matter where I am. And what I first thing that I do is I look for commonality, whatever it is. You know, if we're buying the same vegetables, there's a commonality. You know, how can I turn this into a conversation? And I think that instead of looking and always looking at the differences between us, where, you know, going back to what we said earlier about how to deal with your family and close friends, you know, that aren't where you're at, look for the commonality. Look for the things you two are suffering through together or concerned about together. You know, if you can make them your friend on something trivial or to you, then eventually they might be open to hearing some of what else you know. But, you know, you have to give it to people in a palatable form. You know, Rich, you and I have talked about 9/11 now for 10 years. I find that when I want to talk to somebody, like you said, you can't just say 9/11 was an inside job and walk away, because you're going to get an emotional reaction, especially if they still believe the patriotic myth. What I will do is just bring out 2-3 maximum points and then say, don't you think this is something to look at? You know, and kind of make it so they're not going to have a heart attack and they're not going to want to stab you to death at the same time. Now, I don't want to get myself stabbed, too, because I'm just talking about it. But for me, you know, we could just talk about, you know, there was nothing in the hole in Pennsylvania. There was no plane that could have possibly fit through the hole in the Pentagon. And there's no way those two buildings came down, you know, in 10 seconds. You know, and that's enough. You know, I mean, you can throw in Building 7, but it might be too much. You know, you've got to give people, you know, you got to get that they, like you said, compassionate communication. I don't think it's just speaking. It's also listening and being compassionate about where they're at, you know, like, you know, walk a mile in their moccasin.
Well, I think it's also about getting them to be curious again, because curiosity is decapitated and dismembered during school, because they teach us these pseudo pieces of knowledge and we think we know, therefore we're not curious anymore. So if you were to say to somebody, you don't even have to have a conversation. You know, if they bring up 9/11, you say, wow, you know, what's really interesting. You go research for yourself and check this out. But what's really interesting is if you take a look at the aerial photo of the area where, you know, the plane in Pennsylvania crashed, you'll see something unusual. And if you were to look at that photo, then you see that this big indent in the ground was there before the crash, and they kind of used this natural indentation to stage the site of, you know, of this crash. You know, but all you have to do is send people on a Google search. They find that. Then they're like, whoa, how am I going to deal with this? How am I going to deal with insider trades? How am I going to integrate all those things into what I believe is the official story?
Right. And the story indeed. Story indeed. I'm actually quite glad that John Farmer, who sat on the commission, had his book sent to me, even though he refuses to do an interview. So I don't even know why he sent me the book, but I did start reading the book. Right on the inside jacket. Here's the guy who supposedly led the commission. He said, right early on in the beginning of our investigation, we knew the official story was a fabrication. And so our hands were tied to really do a proper investigation. People criticized him because he didn't say in the book who did it or what the real story was. To me, he didn't have to. He just right there in the first 3 pages tells you the official story was a lie. And this is coming from them. This isn't coming from Pilots for 9/11 Truth or, you know, Scholars for 9/11 Truth. This is coming from a guy who sat on the commission. I use that more than I use any of the 9/11 Truther stuff, because this is the guy who sat on the commission. And I tell people, the name of the book is The Ground Truth. Buy it.
Well, and what you mentioned is not a valid criticism, because what the person who made that criticism, or what we're calling a criticism, they're actually expressing a need and a feeling. They're expressing a need to know who did it, and they're expressing their feeling that this author didn't cover that. Well, it's not a criticism of the author. He covered what he covered, and if your need is outside of that, that is an opportunity for you as an entrepreneur to go and fill that void, which is how I think we all got here. You didn't do this because you saw everyone doing a kick-ass job, and you're like, I can, you know, I let me go try to do that. You're saying there's a big void where there's something that needs to be done that's not being done. I know how to do this. I'm going to focus my attention on getting people the truth every day, as opposed to just trying to entertain them like everyone else is getting paid to in the corporate world.
Right.
It's like you or Jack or any number of people could go be multimillionaires working for the corporation, saying whatever they want you to say. And for some reason, we all walked away from that money and said, I would rather say what comes from my heart instead of going and, you know, barking from your teleprompter every day.
Well, it's not a mystery. It's another word we can do a show on one day called integrity. Integrity really can't be bought. I used to think, Rich, that everybody had a price. You just had to figure out what it was, until I was offered a price based on censorship. And I realized that I couldn't do it. And I said, wow, I guess not everybody does have a price, because I can't.
Well, we're not under that illusion that money has value like they would like us to, you know, If we were under this illusion that money was everything, then we might go for that. But we know better than that from our experience that that is like the most hollowed out thing that you could offer.
Absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Well, Rich, I have to tell you, this was a quick hour. Thanks. It's so fun to have you back on the show. It just seems so long to me.
Well, we got a lot done in the meanwhile. And for anyone listening who would like to see what we've been up to, there's plenty of new podcasts at peacerevolution.org. There's plenty of new film footage at tragedyandhope.com. And wybm.blip.tv has all of our video archives. Everything's free. You can check it all out. And we'll check back with you in a month or so.
Absolutely. Well, take good care. And thanks for the time, Rich.
Hey, thank you, Maria. Thank you, everyone.
You're welcome.
A great day.
Bye. Richard Grove, tragedyandhope.com. I'm sure we'll take you to all his other sites. He's got a huge body of work out. These people are working hard, and the best thing all of us can do is appreciate each other. Appreciate each other and know that you're not alone. And on that note, Richard said, well, I can't go for that. I thought of the song, I can't go for that. Maybe that should be our new mantra. Maybe that's what we should say to TSA. I can't go for that. Anyway, Jim Mars tomorrow's latest book on false flags. You're going to love it. See
Thank
you guys
for listening
tomorrow.
And supporting the Maria Show. Tell others what you learned today. Knowledge becomes wisdom only when it's shared. Encourage others to subscribe today. www.maria.net. Often imitated, never duplicated. A world of information all in one place. www.maria.net. Always ahead of the curve. Always on your side. Get active or get radioactive. Subscribe today.